Thank you. Thank you. Can you hear me? Perfect. I can't see anything, just so you know, if I look very strange, like I have two spotlights on me, and that's all I see. It's an interesting experience. All right. My name is Roel Schaumburg, and I'm going to be talking about the interesting bits of NotPetya. I think most of the people in the room will be familiar with some of the aspects of NotPetya, but there's a lot more to it. Let me do a brief introduction on myself. I spend most of my time on the East Coast, and I've been in InfoSec for about 20 years, give or take. And I've done all sorts of different stuff, from threat intel, malware reversing, black box, white box, whatever. Related to NotPetya, I've also been doing quite a lot of disinformation and fake news research and analysis over the last, I don't know, give or take 5 years. And that's with a focus on North America, Europe, and a little bit of Asia. It helps being multilingual, doing this kind of stuff, and seeing commonalities and differences between different campaigns. And I guess with that, what I'm trying to say is I like working on tactical stuff, so doing, simple reversing, so to say, but I also like looking at strategic long-term campaigns that span months, years, or even longer than that. I will also note that I'm not a lawyer. I'm going to be using a couple terms during this talk, and, some of those terms are contentious. If you want to, argue with me about the definition of war, we can do it after the talk. I won't get very excited, but maybe you will. But whatever floats your boat. You may have also recently seen some of our work in the media looking at the USB fan that was being handed out at the Singapore summit. So that's a little different from, regular reversing. Here's the mandatory marketing slide about the Celsius Advisory Group. I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on here, but, we do a lot of stuff, as you can see here. We do both offensive and defensive work, it's a lot of fun. So here's the agenda for the talk today. I think everybody knows NotPetya, but I want to go a little bit over, what haven't we really publicly talked about? Because there's a very clear narrative that's certainly in the press and so on. And I think there's a couple things that are missing there. So that's what we'll be going over. Right. So, over the last couple years, we've been introduced, if you will, to new types of threats or maybe revived types of threats. Guccifer kind of comes to mind, right, where we, this is kind of something new, something different. And from where I stand, NotPetya kind of, was something different altogether as well. It was a new blend of computer network operations and PsyOps. And, that's what I think it's misunderstood, and that's part of the strategy that the people behind NotPetya were really going for. And what we need to keep in mind here is that we really tend to focus on the tactical level, even, when you look at fake news and disinformation as a whole. We keep talking about Twitter and Facebook bots, and, it's not very forward-looking. My personal takeaway from NotPetya was that NotPetya will be as important as, let's say, Stuxnet or whatever. I think we'll see a book or two, not written by me. I don't like writing books, but that's where we'll go. So let's look at the premise of NotPetya that, everybody should be aware of, but, just as a refresher, right? It's June 27th of last year. It's been give or take a month since WannaCry. Everybody's still kind of, trying to recover from that, assuming you have clients that were victim to that. And all of a sudden, you see another ransom worm or whatever you want to call it break out, and, the mainstream media starts picking up on it, and this is one of the headlines from that particular day, and they're kind of all the same, right? Kind of have this. I'm not sure if the people in the back can read it, right? But it's very clear that there's this huge thing happening in Ukraine, but it's spreading, right? It's spreading to the West, and you know, more and more companies are getting hit, and some of these companies are, let's say, critical infrastructure-ish, while others are very clearly more in the civilian space. So everybody, well, not everybody, but you know, quite a few companies are getting hit, and people are getting sent home. You know, it's that's kind of it. You know, it's like, oh, we are infected, we can't do anything. It's time to go home because IT will be busy recovering this for the rest of the day, right? So, I mean, how big was this? Again, I think most of you people will know, but as we saw in SEC filings and so on, you know, there were numerous multinationals who, you know, calculated the cost at, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars for multiple quarters, right? So that's a lot of money, right? And if you look at the companies that were hit in the West, there are quite a lot of them were in the logistics supply chain, right? And that is, I mean, that's how you move goods, right? So that's critical infrastructure, be that, you know, FedEx or be that Maersk or the Port of Rotterdam. You know, this is vital infrastructure that was down, right? The Port of Rotterdam, the most automated terminal. Terminal 3 was 100% automated. You know, that really hurt. That took weeks to regain full operational capability. And that's really, you know, what we need to think about. We need to redefine costs, right? Because there's a huge difference between, let's say, losing, you know, as a company, losing $1 million. If you're a large multinational, losing $1 million, you know, let's say, you know, just evaporates out of the bank account, you know, that's not really a big deal. You know, that's uncomfortable, that's not cool, but, you know, in the end, you know, it doesn't really matter, it doesn't impact your business productivity, your business continuity. NotPetya, on the other hand, you know, was designed to wreak havoc, you know. Ransomware ultimately, you know, impacts your business continuity process. And again, if you couple that back to the logistics supply chain companies, you know, it really hurt. It, you know, it cripples a business. And if you're a small business, that might actually mean the end of your business. So I want to take a little bit of time going over certain terms again, because when I look at Twitter, and you know, I'm not a Twitter engineer or whatever the new term is when you spend a lot of time on Twitter, you know, sharing your opinion. I like retweet things. That's kind of what I do, and I stick to that. So when most people talk about I/O on Twitter, they're talking about influence operations, even when they say they mean information operations. Information operations, you know, cover the full gamut of electronic warfare, computer network operations, you know, and psychological operations, military deception, all that kind of good stuff. That, you know, that's one big thing, rather than just the influence ops or, you know, the psyops part of it. Right, so this entire conversation that we're trying to have about some of these things, it doesn't help that we're not, you know, sticking to the proper terminology. And, you know, what you can kind of glean from the description of information operations, it's very important to realize that, you know, cyber is only an enabler. And I do apologize, I can't really say the word cyber in earnest. It's so overused, so sometimes I just say cyber. It gets to you. Anyhow, so that is really, you know, the important thing, right? Cyber is not an, you know, it's not an end goal. It's just a means to an end, and that's that. You shouldn't make it more than that. Right, and I want to talk a little bit, you know, about the psyops portion of this, right? And how I don't want to make this a whole, you know, fake news disinformation talk, but you know, the 24-hour news cycle is really driving that tactical narrative, right? Because we're being flooded with new news. So that makes it very, very hard for most people to do the strategic analysis on the one hand, and two, you know, there's no time to read up on strategic analysis. Strategic analysis doesn't really fit into the 24-hour news cycle, which, you know, is of great help for the adversary, but, you know, doesn't help us. And for the most part, therefore, for the most part, it's all about that initial news cycle, unless, you know, the adversary is, you know, trying to push a message for a prolonged period of time by establishing a more strategic narrative. And we'll see, you know, how NotPetya was actually trying to accomplish that a little bit later. And, you know, along the same lines, I've talked to quite a few people who do, like, fact-checking initiatives and so on to try and, you know, show that this was misinformation or disinformation. And, you know, for the general audience, it doesn't really, doesn't move the needle, and it doesn't deter the adversary. If I could actually see the audience, I would ask you guys how many people use two-factor authentication. I would probably see like a significant amount of people, but again, I can't see anything. And you know, that shows that you know, we are not the general audience. Most people don't use two-factor authentication, or certainly not for, you know, their own accounts. Maybe they're mandated by their employer, but, you know, I think Google said like less than 1% of Gmail users use 2FA. So, you know, we are not the general audience, right? So kind of have to always keep that in mind. What's the messaging here, and who's the intended audience? So, right, where it gets really interesting is when you start looking at cross-domain, multi-layer information operations. Because at that point, you can start using complexity as a weapon. And if you couple that back to the 24-hour news cycle, it gets even better, right? So in general, and with NotPetya in particular, you need a lot of expertise in a lot of different areas to, you know, get a proper appreciation of what the responsible team was trying to achieve, right? And I know we as a community, we tend to dislike security through obscurity, but complexity is definitely a weapon when, you know, you need subject matter experts in both computer science, you know, and the humanities and all that good stuff, and you kind of have to get them together into a room, and, you know, and the lawyers too, don't forget the lawyers. And you have to get everybody into a room and you know, kind of do that analysis. And everybody does their analysis, and you kind of have to do analysis on that and kind of try and figure out, you know, what are people going for here? And that, you know, who has time for that, right? Who does that? Plus, you know, how do I write IOCs for this? You know, that gets very complicated. I just want my, you know, my IOCs, I want my, you know, my malicious domains, my hashes, some other stuff, you know, put that into my sim, and I want to be done with it. I don't want to think about, you know, any of this stuff. Like, what do I do with that? All right? But overall, right, like why in this particular space, you know, do you have this that is influence op element to it? Well, it's for the most part about maintaining plausible deniability. And that plausible deniability doesn't need to persist, you know, forever. Just like, you know, when we talk about encryption, we, you know, for the most part, you kind of think, well, you know, if I encrypt it today, it will be good for, you know, 20 years. Well, no, you know, that's not it. You know, we should not expect the encryption of today to be good for, you know, good in 20 years. That's unlikely. Some additional perspective on, you know, influence ops, psyops, whatever you want to call them, right, is from Yuri Bezmenov. I think he was actually being mentioned on Twitter again this week, and a lot of people like referencing his talk from, I think, the 1984, and go figure. But what is important to realize here is that Bezmenov actually defected in 1970. So you can go on YouTube and you can go watch his talks and, you know, get a better appreciation for what strategic psyops really are, right? It's not, you know, something that, not a campaign that lasts for 3 or 6 months or 1 or 2 years. No, you know, ultimately this could be a multi-generational effort, right? And then you can contrast with that to the conversation that we're currently having about, you know, how the American public is being influenced. And we talk about, you know, Facebook bots and Twitter bots. It's very, very primitive compared to what Yuri was talking about. And again, 1970 is close to 50 years ago, right? 50 years ago is like virtually two generations. So we can safely assume that, you know, these methods and tactics have really evolved through that half century. So from the technical perspective, I'm sure that everybody here is familiar with ransomware, right? You have different tier operators. Some people do the encryption well. Some people, you know, really suck. Some people just lie and say that, you know, your stuff is encrypted. You know, whatever makes money, right? And ransomware was and still is really quite popular. And that makes a lot of sense from a cybercrime perspective, because if you want to steal somebody's, you know, banking information and drain their bank account or steal their credit card information, you have to worry about things like fraud controls, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, if you either go after individuals or target a company with ransomware, you know, there's either personal photos or, you know, a business continuity problem that, you know, that particular target, you know, they want to get that fixed. So if the target decides to pay the attacker money, you know, they intend to do that. They want to make that transaction happen. So that's really attractive for the attacker. But what ransomware also is, right, it's a great cover for action, right? As I said, ransomware, if you target a company, effectively, it, you know, stops your business productivity, right? So what if you just decide, you know, to deploy that ransomware and, you know, no matter how much money the target is going to give you, you're never going to give them the decryption keys for their files or for their, you know, whatever the attacker just encrypted, server images, you name it, right? So this really is very convenient from an attacker perspective, right? Because we think of ransomware as some criminal thing, it's for criminal elements, but really anyone can use it for a computer network attack, right? A disruptive type of attack. So this cover is great because it isn't immediately obvious, you know, who is behind this and what the motivation is for this particular attack. You know, unlike, let's say, Stuxnet, right? If you want to look back to Stuxnet, which, you know, people love to, you know, talk about Stuxnet. So in this regard, you can kind of see, you know, all these old days, you know, oh, just targeting, you know, nuclear stuff in the tons. Well, you know, there's only a handful of countries in the world with the necessary facilities to test Stuxnet and see if it works, right? So it's kind of like, you know, your special forces team. When you see them, you know what they are, right? So it's all clandestine. The special forces team tries to remain hidden, all that good stuff. But, you know, if they get exposed, you know what they are, and, you know, it's very obvious. Ransomware is much better in that regard. Which leads me to the, you know, into the logical evolution of the question, you know, what is attribution? And, you know, how much of the conversation we have in the public domain these days is really just conjecture. Right, because what is real attribution? And I would add that that particular question becomes more important as the geopolitical stakes get higher, right? So if you want to look at something like, you know, NotPetya, you don't want to be looking at the Martha. I don't know, you know, who watches the Americans here or who watched the Americans here, but, you know, Poor Martha, you know, worked for the FBI. She got recruited by the KGB, you know, and she did work, you know, she did work for them, right? But from an intelligence perspective, you know, obviously Martha matters, but from a greater intelligence perspective, you know, who is controlling Martha, right? So you know, proper attribution can only be done through infiltration. And that, you know, be that, you know, real human infiltration or technical infiltration, you know, that is clearly the domain of governments. That is not the domain of the private sector. So most of the attribution conversation that I see in the public space is mostly conjecture, certainly as the stakes get higher, right? And the nation state actors have, you know, special capabilities both on the offensive and defensive side, right? So you need to know about motive and intent, right? Like with the indictments that we saw recently, right? Against the from the DOJ to GRU, you see like they have an idea of the command structure, they have the names, right? So at that point, it becomes the story becomes reasonably clear. This was a, you know, these were approved operations, et cetera, et cetera, right? This wasn't somebody doing something in their free time, you know, using company infrastructure. No, this was an actual op. So that you know, that is the kind of detail that really is needed when you go into this particular space. And again, that is government stuff. So that leads me very quickly into NotPetya attribution. You know, I think CIA, GCHQ, and others have come out. You know, this all points to GRU, APT 28 in particular. I mean, you've been reading the news, so I think that's pretty clear. Even I have a White House statement in it, right, where the White House says NotPetya is the most costly attack that we've seen today, right? So that's, I think, fairly well established, and there hasn't been any evidence, you know, to suggest anything otherwise, right? So once you have established that, you know, that, you know, the GRU was the team behind NotPetya, right, you kind of need to look at the bigger picture and get an appreciation for, you know, how this particular actor behaves. Because, again, cyber is only an enabler, right? And given that, you know, it's GRU, it's NotPetya, or quote-unquote originated in Ukraine, so, you know, you kind of have to look into that particular context, right? So Russia annexed Crimea in 2014, and ever since, you know, it's been, as I say, you know, all IO all the time. It's, you know, it's one big mess. And throughout the last couple of years, or throughout those, I guess, four years, you have seen very targeted sabotage operations against, you know, power plants, et cetera, et cetera. But NotPetya clearly was something different, right? It spread to other countries. Well, it didn't really spread. You know, it was, you know, it was unleashed on other countries as well, if you will. So, right, I guess the point with this particular slide is trying to make is that when we look at this particular actor's behavior also in the physical domain, right, we see that it's all about plausible deniability. I'm not sure, you know, who here remembers the little green men that started showing up in Crimea in 2014, but, you know, it was something entirely different. They didn't have the little patches on, you know, they were unmarked, which is not okay by international norms, to say the least, right? And, you know, that initial deniability, you know, just allowed things to move on and move on. And I think today, you know, the Russian government has been quite open about, you know, how it was them all along. But, you know, as you, the objective here really is to make it more expensive to react to a particular act from the adversary. And that expense could be either in resources or in political capital, right? Who wants to respond to something that happened, you know, one or two years ago, right? It's much easier to just kind of let it slide, right? And that kind of brings me to, you know, my trigger word, which is hybrid warfare. Excuse me while I drink. So for those unfamiliar, hybrid warfare really is some relatively new term and talks about, you know, the idea of irregular asymmetric warfare where the adversary is using different, you know, mechanisms to really, you know, toe the line and, you know, remain in that conflict boundary to not, you know, to not do actual acts of war, but, you know, just skirt the line. So it's kind of like a legal game, and as I said, I'm not a lawyer, but, you know, lawyers get really animated about this, right? So this is where there is, you know, where there is unclarity or gaps in the law, that's just operational opportunity for the adversary, right? So Russia in particular loves playing in this space. Personally, from where I stand, I dislike the term hybrid warfare. Excuse me while I drink. To me, that is a concept, you know, that I don't think that our adversaries believe in the concept of peacetime, and and therefore there is no such thing as hybrid warfare. That's my opinion. Well, on that wonderful note, I want to move on to, you know, to actually NotPetya, you know, to kind of, you know, talk about that more, you know, on the tactical level. So NotPetya, you know, was being pushed through this mandatory, sort of quasi-mandatory tax accounting software that's used if you want to do business in Ukraine, right? And it's not like, so if you do business with any entities in Ukraine, even as a you know, a foreign company, you know, you need to use one of two approved tax accounting software, and MeDoc was the name of the software that NotPetya was being pushed through, right? So from a CNO perspective, this was done superbly well, because the C2 channel was actually hosted on the MeDoc infrastructure itself, right? So there's nothing suspicious at all, right? If you just kind of do some casual traffic analysis and so on, then even as the implant is being pushed out to the targets, it just goes, right? So all those wonderful seams out there, they would not have picked up that kind of behavior. Plus, it's a trusted channel, right? It's trusted software, or whatever that means these days, right? So from a CNO perspective, this was really well done. This was really smooth, and would have a very, very high chance of, you know, not being picked up, at least initially, by security software, right? And as this implant was being pushed out through the trusted supply chain, right? And, you know, the malware got installed onto the victim boxes, you know, NotPetya would start encrypting or destroying these files, and after some amount of time, the machine would reboot and give you, you know, that particular screen. If you want to, you know, recover your files, here's the Bitcoin address, you know, send us $300 worth of Bitcoin to this particular address, and then send your Bitcoin wallet ID to this particular email address. And then very, very, very quickly, you know, somebody thought it was a smart idea to shut down this email address, which, you know, when you're dealing with a global outbreak, maybe that's not, you know, what you want to do, because sometimes, you know, file recovery and paying the attacker is still better than not having your files. Yes, plus it helps tracking. That's entirely true. So why, you know, well, whatever. I mean, not the point, but that annoyed me. Again, it's important here to realize that every user of this MeDoc software was getting the software, and every person or company that wants to do business in or with Ukraine, was running either MeDoc or the other piece of software, right? So that was the target. Target demographic was users of MeDoc software. So as I said, you know, it starts spreading within your local network, what was interesting about NotPetya versus WannaCry, right? WannaCry kind of indiscriminately went after WAN addresses, just, you know, spreading globally very, very aggressively. Again, the NotPetya actors decided that they want to keep the spreading mechanism local, right? So again, that is non-discriminate targeting of specific networks. A lot was said about, you know, how it was using Eternal Blue, you know, the leaked exploit and all that. And that was, from my perspective, very interesting. I'll get back to that in a little bit. So it was using Eternal Blue, Mimikatz, PSXsec, and WMI to do all this lateral movement and just spreading within these networks, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, $10 billion worth of damages, you know, that's the estimate. Okay, right? So that was that. So it was very expensive, you know, it targeted, you know, these users of this tax software, right? So let's look at the narrative evolution for a little bit, right? So this is where it kind of gets interesting, right? So what the attackers had done very cleverly, right, is they had taken this existing piece of malware called Petya, an existing ransomware, and they had manually patched it. And you know, I would love to go through the manual patching effort with all you guys, but, you know, I only have like 45 minutes, and ultimately that is not the point. The point was that, you know, they took a piece of malware to an existing piece of malware to confuse researchers, right, and to get that initial narrative out there. Is now, oh, we have this new strain of ransomware. It's using, you know, Eternal Blue, and, you know, things are not looking so good. And then because the email account got taken down very shortly after, the narrative was really all about, you know, well, you can't recover your files. So fast forward a little bit, and it becomes clear, hey, this is a patched piece of malware. You know, this is a false flag operation, right? And in cyber, false flag operations haven't been that exciting, right? But in the real world, we have seen false flag operations lead to actual, you know, people countries getting drawn into war. So, you know, those are sort of the stakes, right? Again, it's not a technical cyber. Point. So it becomes clear this is something else, and it also turns out that, hey, that you know, that entire ransomware narrative, you know, the decryption will never work, so recovery is impossible even if that account was active, you know, and that kind of becomes the narrative, and that's kind of it, right? And kind of look at the retrospectives from last month, and that's kind of where people go, well, you know, that was interesting, and kind of leave it at that, right? But that sounds obvious, but obviously there's a little more. And I don't think the stuff that it's, you know, where I'm coming from, that we've had any public conversation about this, which, again, makes, you know, properly analyzing these campaigns much more complicated. So if we look at the spreading mechanism of NotPetya, you know, it was all about that lateral movement. You had the initial deployment to the MDoC users, and then all those different mechanisms were about lateral movement. But as anyone, you know, anyone who's ever done red team exercising can tell you, you know, PSExec, WMI, Mimikatz are more than enough to spread through a network, right? And I hadn't mentioned this yet, but we actually had some clients that were affected by NotPetya. And, you know, this is what we saw here as well. Also, after, you know, post-WannaCry, most people wanted to apply the Eternal Blue patches, et cetera, et cetera. I'm strongly convinced, I'm 100% certain, that the inclusion of Eternal Blue was not needed for CNO success, right? But the inclusion of Eternal Blue, also right following WannaCry, right after WannaCry, you know, became a major narrative around NotPetya, right? And it kind of reinforced the narrative of WannaCry, right? Here were these, you know, these exploits, these evil exploits, you know, and this is a problem, right? You saw the U.S. government, you saw them respond to, you know, you didn't necessarily see them respond to NotPetya, you saw them respond to the fallout of, you know, the GRU leveraging Eternal Blue, right? So that was a very distinct narrative change. So from where I stand, it would be absolutely brilliant from a SIOP perspective, an influence op, you know, to include Eternal Blue just to sway that narrative, right? And I think, you know, if that were the case, if the actor did do that, I think they succeeded in this very, very well, right? And this is something that I don't think has been explored at all in the public domain, of not just doing, you know, some sort of false flag, but deliberately planting particular technical measures, if you will, to drive a particular narrative. And you know, and that I think makes things a little bit more complicated, and we need better strategic analysis, because if you're just trying to hit that 24-hour news cycle, this is going to be overlooked. Right. So, all right. So, if we look at the Eternal Blue aspect, we also have to, you know, and put that kind of in a different light. We also need to be talking a little bit more about, you know, what was the what is the bigger agenda here? And again, that is very, very hard because, you know, attribution versus conjecture. But what we can do by looking at the facts, right? Like, we know that the GRU was inside the MEDOC infrastructure, you know, ahead of time. They didn't just, you know, get into the MEDOC infrastructure and immediately deployed NotPetya. You know, there was a reconnaissance phase. They had an idea of, you know, who was using this. Plus, obviously, GRU are Ukraine experts, right? This should be obvious, right? So they have a very deep knowledge of their adversary. So they have an understanding of what this looks like and who uses it. So again, the target was MEDOC users. It wasn't MEDOC users in Ukraine, right? And that's an important distinction. You can make the argument here that most of the ops that were conducted in this way were really strictly focused on Ukraine. So was this sloppy work from an otherwise very, very tidy team, and a team that, you know, many consider to be, you know, on the top of their game? It's hard to tell, again, without having that insight knowledge. But that plausible deniability is something that they love to leverage. And the intended the effects of NotPetya, right? Certainly against the logistics supply chain. These are indistinguishable from what would be an legitimate objective during quote-unquote cyber war, right? If there's an actual conflict, a real conflict or actual war, you know, an adversary would love to hit, you know, ports and so on. They would love to hit the equivalent of a FedEx, et cetera, because it deprives the enemy from shipping, you know, goods, be that food or be that, you know, other types of supplies, military supplies, and so on, right? So this was either, you know, a test run, you know, an intended test run, or, you know, an accidental test run to see, you know, how the West would respond, both, you know, on an operational level as well as a policy level, which, you know, given the response we've seen so far from the West, you know, I think it you're potentially looking at, you know, an opportunity for further escalation, which, you know, wouldn't help anyone. You know, on July 4th, give or take a week after NotPetya hit, you know, we got the usual, you know, persona. You got to have a persona, you know, as these ops go. And, you know, it was a little message about, you know, give me a bunch of Bitcoin and, you know, I'll make the master decryption key available. And, I mean, this is just about, you know, getting another free news cycle. And at that point, they're not targeting the mainstream, you know, the general audience. They're targeting more the tech sites out there, so to say. And it's a free news cycle for them, right? It allows them to drive out that narrative. And I think most of the, you know, most of the news organizations who cover this particular thing, again, reiterated the issue of them leveraging Eternal Blue, right? And we again, that was a major part of the narrative around NotPetya. And, you know, from my personal point of view, our devices are, you know, continually vulnerable. They're not just vulnerable between that window of when Microsoft releases the patches, a new patch. You know, that is not the window, you know, of vulnerability. The window of vulnerability is constant. So, you know, when we look at all of this, right, so what does all of this mean, right? What does this say about doctrine, right? Because that's ultimately what this is. When we do APT research, right, and any of this stuff, this ties into, you know, an adversary's or a particular actor's doctrine, you know. And, excuse me. So when we look at these operations, right, be them Guccifer or NotPetya, et cetera, they're effectively an embodiment of this doctrine. So whatever doctrine is published, right, whatever doctrine, military doctrine that we see published, that might, you know, give something away about what a particular nation state finds acceptable in a particular domain. But, you know, actions speak louder than words. So with that particular thing in mind, right, you can kind of see, you can start discerning what a particular actor finds acceptable behavior. And this kind of widespread, you know, computer network attack is definitely, you know, something different. Certainly, because, again, NotPetya targeted every user of MeDoc, not just Ukrainian users of MeDoc, right? So all of a sudden, all these companies that do business with Ukraine are being drawn into this conflict, right? So all of a sudden, all these international companies are being drawn into that, right? And they're just, you know, they're in peacetime. There's no conflict there. So all of a sudden, they are drawn into that, which raises the bigger question, right? If this is acceptable behavior, right? Or maybe it was a mistake and it was all just sloppy work, but if this was acceptable, you know, then what else is acceptable? And, you know, furthermore, it wasn't just legitimate military targets that were being hit by NotPetya. It was also civilian targets, you know, which is, this is just a huge no-no, you know. No, it's not cool. And then the other thing is, you know, how targeted is that destructive payload? Going back to Stuxnet, right? Stuxnet infected hundreds of thousands of machines globally. But, you know, the operators made very sure to only target very specific PLCs, right? They would only ever go after PLCs in Natanz. So even though Stuxnet was found in plants elsewhere in the world, you know, it was quote-unquote harmless there. I just got the five-minute warning sign, so that's good. This is my penultimate slide, and I hope to have time for like one or two questions. I think that, you know, kind of revisiting NotPetya, one of my major takeaways was that NotPetya is a non-ICS threat, right? It's a Windows thing, right? Everybody talks about Windows. But Most of the ICS environments out there, for instance, at a port, or a shipping company, they need input, right? The ICS environments are not self-contained. They need information with regards to orders, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, guess what? That information comes from Windows machines for the most part. So we saw a non-ICS threat take down all these ICS environments. Because again, if there's no data input, there's nothing for the ICS environment to do, right? We should let that sink in for a bit, right? So this is a very, very interesting element as well, right? We don't need, let's say, a Stuxnet to take down an ICS environment. You can just do it this way, and you can do it with perfect plausible deniability, right? So you can make the argument, right? The plausible deniability of, well, it was not an ICS threat, and it was a worm, and therefore it spread uncontrollably, but both complexity and automation introduced deniability. So this is a great advantage for attackers. And seeing this become more mainstream, I do believe that NotPetya was a template, and a lot of actors, just as we saw a lot of innovation after Stuxnet, we will see more innovation on this multifaceted, multi-domain operations in the foreseeable future, and that's just going to make things more complicated for everyone. And I think the previous presenters are kind of touching that on it as well. Like we need people who understand both the policy side, the technical side, and all the different domains, because right now, the cross-domain, multi-layered information operation realm is asymmetric warfare gold, and the adversary is experienced and good at it, and we are not responding, which only leads to further escalation. And on that happy note, I want to mention that we have a blog post coming up in the next couple days on doctrinal cyber on celsusio.blog. I hope in the next 2 days. And with that, I hope I have 1 minute left for questions. Thank you. I can't see a thing if there's anyone.
Hello, thanks for the sum up of the events. I was a little bit confused by your anger about the takedown of the mail address, because from my knowledge, the research from Kapersky showed that NotPetya was a viper and didn't show any way to recover the data. So by taking down the address, people were prevented from useless payments of bitcoins.
That's true, but at the time of takedown, that wasn't known yet. So my argument was that when we are confronted with this type of scenario, our first response should not be to take down the email address. Our first response should be to observe and analyze. Does that make sense?
And so risk people paying money and funding possibly terrorists without any chance to get their data? So I think it's a two-sided sword. You can... Can't
Fair
tell
enough.
Which
it's
is
it's a different way of looking at things. Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Hi. Over a year ago, argued that NotPetya was what a digital sanctions regime would look like, and if you time it with the timing of sanctions imposed on Ukraine and so forth, it would make sense. But a question I have for you is, how do you separate, if you do? I know that the federal government has attributed WannaCry to North Korea. I'm not sure that that's correct, but how do you separate NotPetya from WannaCry and from Bad Rabbit?
There's no public evidence, right, to suggest that WannaCry was GRU. Bad Rabbit does seem connected to NotPetya. And I think there was a little bit more of restraint when it came to Bad Rabbit rather than NotPetya. And with regards to the sanctions, I do agree. My original take on it was that, these are economic sanctions, effectively, right, for anyone who's doing business in or with Ukraine. And I think I have to close it down. If anyone has any questions, find me outside. Thank you.